RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 226 with guest Laura Hunter, recorded Wednesday, August 17th, 2011. Run As Radio is produced each week by WAP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, another episode of Run As Radio, and with me today is Laura Hunter. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. I mean, you've been on the show before, so I was going to read your bio, but it's wrong. It's terribly terrible. You're not an MVP anymore, are you?
I am not an MVP. I don't get to play in the cool kids club anymore, except that I do, because I still crash the parties whenever y'all come to campus.
Of course, because you've crossed over now. You are part of the empire.
I am. I have a shiny blue badge with my name on it.
That's
it's very
nice.
Cool.
Are you actually in Redmond much? Because I thought you were based on the East Coast.
So I split time between Redmond and Philadelphia. My whole family's in Philadelphia. I've got, you know, obligations there to take care of my parents and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so when I interviewed for the job with Microsoft, they said, "Hey, we really want you to come on board. We really want you to move to Redmond." And I said, "I really want to come on board and I really want to take the job, but I'm a grown up with grown up responsibilities and I can't relocate."
Right.
And to their eternal credit, they said, "Okay, remote access works. We have other people who do what you do." So it basically just means I have a 2,400-mile commute to work, you know, every couple of weeks or so.
I know that one well. I've always said I have two commutes, either 40 feet or 4,000 miles and very little in between.
That precisely sums up my job, yes.
Good on the air miles, though.
Oh, it's wonderful. I don't remember the last time I flew coach.
So what got you to switch over? What were you after?
So the job offer actually came from some folks that I had known while I was still working in the consulting space. You know, we'd been familiar with each other at the different conferences and you know, at your Tech Eds and your Directory Experts conference, the one that Quest puts on. And I got a call one day from one of the guys from Microsoft internal IT, specifically their internal identity and access management practice. And he calls me up and says, "Laura, I know you're making just a boatload of money as a consultant." And, well, let's be honest, I was. but we've got some really nifty, neat, hard identity management problems within MSIT that need solving. And you're just going to have a lot of fun trying to, you know, trying to solve them and getting to play with all the new toys before anybody else does.
It's nifty.
It's like the guys in the product group are Santa's elves, and I'm the kid waiting under the Christmas tree, but I get to open the presents like in June instead of having to wait until Christmas. So it's awesome.
I got to think you've also dealing with a fair bit of dog food here that you have to deal with what doesn't work yet.
Oh, absolutely. Microsoft IT is, we are always, always dog fooding. By the time a beta product of something new reaches even the earliest external TAP partners or the MVP community, internally to MSIT, we've already been working on it for at least weeks, if not months.
You're already soaked in blood.
Oh yeah, we've already seen all the really early gnarly stuff before we let it out into even the very early beta testers of the rest of the world.
So what bits of this can you even talk about?
So unfortunately we are so early in the vNext process that
right.
that I can't actually say very much about Win8. I can call it Win8 now because, you know, some conference a couple of months ago actually used those words.
Right.
So I don't have to check myself from saying Winit anymore, which is awesome. But in terms of the what features are being released or anything, you know, we're still not reasonably at plan of record yet. Have me back in about 6 months. I'll have much more fun dog fooding stories to tell you about Winit, because those are always the fun stories to tell, is how we took down Corp for 4 hours for fun and profit.
Nice. Yes.
Which we actually did during the Windows Server 2008 dog fooding. We took down all of Corp for 4 hours on the last day of financial close. That was not a fun postmortem.
Yeah, I bet that was a tough day.
That was a bad day in Redmond. Yes.
Yeah, pretty exciting, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me a sense of the scope of the identity problem, Microsoft? How many accounts? Like, what are we managing? What's the architecture look like?
Sure. So within Microsoft, I mean, you think of Microsoft as a software company and as a services company,
yeah.
And we are, but we're also just a Fortune 100 organization with, you know, people whose services need to work. If we think about the number of accounts that we're managing, we've got, depending on whether you count vendors, we have probably 150,000 user accounts. What's interesting about that is that we have probably three times as many computers.
Right, of course.
And the reason for that is that, well, lots and lots of software developers, so everyone's got three boxes under their desk. Everyone's an admin on their desktop, and, you know, people have, you know, the latest version of everything that they want to play with, and, you know, we have to just support the bleeding edge of everything that's out there. We also have that's kind of our internal network. That's who you think of as the blue badges. We also have a very active relationship with hundreds of thousands of our partners. So we have folks from, you know, our OEM infrastructure and our business partners who we give early access to specs and to bits and whatnot. If you've ever seen a partners account from Microsoft, mm-hmm. You know, partners WAC J. Smith. That is a separate Active Directory that we run out in our extranet, and we have an identity management process there. And there's a whole sponsorship workflow that goes with it. You know, an FTE needs to sponsor your partner's account. They need to revalidate it every 3 months, you know, going forward. And there's a whole, you know, this person who never sees Redmond and never sees a CorpNet connected account, what do we do when they forget their password?
Right.
You know, it's this whole other set of workflows that we have to manage for our business partners.
Yeah, I've actually been on that side of the equation where, you know, you guys are pretty tough. You need steady password changes, you need constant renewals, and, you know, if I go off and do other things for a while, generally all my Microsoft accounts are dead. And you have to call up your sponsor and go through the process and get everything activated again.
Yep. Yes, indeed.
It is a plan. It is very organized.
Yes, yes. And it very much needs to be. Otherwise, chaos will reign.
Well, especially at this scale, it's just so many accounts.
Oh, absolutely. And it's just a really interesting, it's an interesting field to be in. I mean, identity interests me because there are so many challenges that we haven't solved yet. There's so much work to be done to make the cloud and the internet in general a secure place to do business. And identity is at the heart of it all.
Sure.
Because everything you do in the cloud, everything you do in the internet hinges on the ability to prove that a person is who they say they are, and then being able to control what resources they can access once you've determined who they are. And there's just so much that goes along with that we know the problems that need to be solved. We just haven't figured out how to solve them.
But Laura, we have Active Directory Federated Services. It's solved. Everything is perfect now. Didn't you know?
Authentication? We've nailed authentication. It's done. We're set. Except for the fact that passwords are dead.
Yes.
And everyone knows how much passwords suck.
Yes.
The only problem is that it's like, what was the, I think it was the Winston Churchill line of, you know, democracy is the worst form of government except for everything else.
Yes.
Yes, we know all of the weaknesses associated with passwords and all of the reasons why we shouldn't be using passwords anymore. But what else are we going to do?
Right. Well, Microsoft issues smart cards to everybody, right?
So we do issue smart cards to everyone in the company. They are for right now. They have they're specifically used for like for RAS access, for remote access, also for administrator access.
Right.
We had attempted an initiative a couple of years ago, which was effectively eliminating passwords entirely in mm-hmm. favor of smart cards. For various and sundry technical reasons, that didn't work so well. But now it's a couple of years later, and the technology has moved forward, and also the risks associated with passwords have moved forward.
Right.
And so we are, you know, one of the things that we're looking at is how can we use strong authentication, and how can we improve the strength of our users' authentication moving forward. And I mean, some of it is technical. Some of it is also just kind of a people and process kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at just normal people living in Europe,
right.
Take them as an example, they are completely familiar with, completely accustomed to having effectively an RSA key fob on their keychain to access their online banking website.
Right.
Every online banking website in Europe uses a one-time password key fob, and people in Europe are just used to that.
Right.
But if you look at, you know, generally Americans culturally, we haven't gotten there yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your bank sent you a fob and said you have to keep this around to access your online banking, that's going to be a culture shift, and that's going to be a mind shift, because it's not something that we're used to yet. But we need to get there, because that's where the world is going.
And I mean, for better or worse, RSA Secure ID had a bad month a couple of months ago. They had a breach, and a bunch of codes were violated, and it was a whole lot of replacing tokens.
Yep. If you read a postmortem of the actual incident, it's actually very interesting. It's interesting to read about the technical aspect of the breach in terms of how very limited in scope it is.
Right.
I mean, the only fobs that were actually affected were keys that were issued, I think, like during the months of March and April. And everything before that and everything after that was fine.
Right.
But it was such a PR hit for them that it was that you're now looking at, well, what does this mean for the credibility of OTP in general?
Yeah, well, and you see, this is absolutist tendencies. Like, once something's breached once, it's garbage forever.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of when Intel had that bizarre little flaw in one of their processors that it only affected one little batch, and it was only this very particular math problem, but suddenly nobody wanted an Intel processor. And Intel mm-hmm. simply, even though it made economic sense directly, it's like, look, those processors, you know, they said, we're replacing them all. You know, as much as it may have cost them, the PR cost was higher.
Mm-hmm. Even if you were affected by one of those keys that was breached during those, I guess, two really bad months,
yeah,
there was an additional attack that needed to happen. So the bad guy not only needed the bad key, he needed to be able to circumvent like other logical controls on one of your systems. So it was actually a very sophisticated attack that would have needed to happen.
Right.
But like you said, we're now looking at the public relations fallout of, well, we still believe in, I think as an industry, we still believe in strong auth is good and one-time passwords are good. So now let's find a way to rebuild the trust level, not trust in the technical sense, but trust in the consumer sense.
Well, and I got to think, I've been working with some companies that are depending on Secure ID, who just are looking at, you know, when a situation like that happens, and they get pushback from senior non-technical management saying, why are we using these things if they obviously don't work? They're mm-hmm. They're actually the advocate going through the actual cost of what it's going to take to switch to something else, and what the heck do you switch to?
Yep, and it's an education process. This was the extent of the damage. This is how we are protecting ourselves from that damage.
Right.
Let's move on.
Yeah, and the reality, of course, is that people simply aren't switching away from Secure ID. It's just too expensive. And when you actually understand the exposure, there's no exposure for most folks.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about biometrics? Like actually something associated with the person themselves, the fingerprints, or God knows, iris readers. Like, where are you on that?
Biometrics are interesting. They certainly have a place. They certainly have applications in, you know, like the James Bond high security environments. There are some very real considerations to keep in mind with biometrics, such as, you know, the canonical example being, I can't revoke my finger.
Right.
So the security of how you are securing your database of fingerprints becomes extremely important.
Yes.
Because if someone gains access to the JPEG file or whatever it is that contains the image of my fingerprint, that becomes very difficult to work around because, well, it's not like I can get new ones.
Yeah.
There's also, again, just getting back to the human element, you have questions around form factor. Like there are people who, you know, if you told them that they had to stick their eye up against some kind of retinal scanner, they might be afraid to do it.
Yeah.
They might be concerned if you know the hygiene of it. So I think as a technology, obviously biometrics are incredibly secure because it's something you have, something you are.
Right.
You know, my fingerprints are very hard to fake, barring that very outside attack of being able to steal a JPEG image of whatever. But aside from that very James Bondian, outside chance, you know, fingerprints and retinal scans, these things are very nearly impossible to spoof, very nearly impossible to fake.
Have you played with Kinect? Because
Kinect?
Yeah.
I love my Kinect.
Well, and I'm fascinated by the fact that Kinect knows when I walk in front of it.
Yes.
You know, and it just, to me, I get away from the game side. The games are fine, whatever. My daughters love it. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of it from a security perspective. Like, mount this thing on my monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite feature would be a policy thing that says, if you're looking at a high security window and Kinect can see another face in its space, it blacks the window out.
Well, that's pretty cool.
I just think
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
There are easy fallouts from that, right? It's just this, yeah, I can now see the space around you. I can probably recognize you by your particular shape, your particular movements.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it lends itself to a real natural passive biometric measurement.
Right, kind of like the guy from the FBI or the NSA who takes work home from him and shuts the office door and locks it so his kids can't come in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And to your example, if they happen to walk in the room to ask daddy for a glass of water, poof,
it takes care of itself.
It takes care of itself.
Yeah, it's just interesting. The idea that giving computers a sense of the space around you and incorporating that into our policies and security items just, I think opens a lot of interesting doors.
Yeah, because that's kind of a natural progression from biometrics.
Mm-hmm.
This is who you are, not in the sense of here's what my fingerprint is, but here is me, 5'5", long brown hair. And other generally recognizable, you know, physical features.
Yeah. But, you know, if you think about the natural behaviors of people and you kept track of that in detail, like if I'm working on my workstation has an incredible amount of information about how I use it, how I use a mouse, how I type, you know, the timing between the keystrokes, the kinds of things I do. I gotta bet that if you built up a database of that, I could figure out over time, within a few minutes of using a machine, you're not you.
Mm-hmm.
And that just opens the door again to this. Imagine you know, the machine gives you the benefit of the doubt initially, and it's like, wait a second, you're not acting right. Answer this question. I'm gonna up security on this.
Mm-hmm.
I think Facebook's done a pretty good job of this, where Facebook tends to, you know, you've never logged on with this machine before, in this location before, so let me jump you through a couple extra hoops before we go ahead.
I actually encountered that a couple of weeks ago. I was at a friend's wedding in Bremen, Germany, and I hopped on the internet from the hotel, and what's the first thing we all do? We all go to Facebook.
Right.
And Facebook immediately said, you're on kind of a funky IP address.
Right.
Relative to your previous behavior. So I'm going to ask you to punch your password in again. And not only did the web interface ask me to punch my password in again, but I immediately got an email to, you know, the email on that's in my Facebook profile saying, hey, this thing just happened and you should be aware of it.
I'm
actually pretty impressed by that.
Well, yeah, I like that as a, you know, sensitive to unusual behavior kind of thing. The same way that I mean, I actually appreciate it when the credit card company calls me and says, hey, did you do some transactions in London?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that gives me confidence in that company that they're noticing that's out of the ordinary. And when I say yes, I usually say, hey, thanks very much for calling. Like, I appreciate you're looking out for me.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm just wondering if we can get Windows to that point where the Windows has a sense that we really want this machine to be secure. I really want the person using it to be the person they say they are. And I want you to pick up on that in some way.
Yep. And you've just described why I love my job, because there are so many challenges in identity and so many different ways that we can solve them. And, you know, if we look at how the industry as a whole, not just Microsoft, we look at how the industry as a whole is solving these problems, because they're, you know, it's common to the industry, and it's the whole, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. So if Microsoft can do something to make the identity ecosystem more secure, then it's more secure for everyone. If Facebook, if Amazon, if Google, whoever does something to make the identity ecosystem more secure and make the cloud and make the internet more secure, I say rock on, because that makes my life that much more secure.
Well, and I'm finding folks that are generally saying OpenID and its ilk have failed. But where that's sort of died, we're seeing the success of log on with your Twitter account and log on with your Facebook account. I'm not sure how I feel about this.
So the interesting thing about what we call the NASCAR page, so you log on and there's all these different logos of all these different identity providers that you can log on with, it becomes a matter of, so from the end user perspective, it's a matter of convenience.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the most convenient identity for me to use to get my job done? That's kind of the user-centric approach. The enterprise-centric approach is which identity provides the level of assurance that I need to control access to my resources. So, like, if we look at my logon to Amazon.com, you know, it's a username and a password. It's one of my email addresses and a password. And in order for me to log on to that site, the level of assurance that Amazon is looking for is basically that I was the same person who logged on last time.
Right.
And the reason they want to do that is so that they can say things like, "Welcome back, Laura. Would you like to buy more shoes?" And invariably the answer is yes. But then when we get to what I would call a high value transaction. So when we get to a transaction that's actually going to cost me money.
Right.
That transaction is not actually guarded by my username and password. That transaction is authorized by my bank.
Right.
Because it's authorized by my credit card.
Well, in the case of Amazon, it flips to HTTPS and it generally asks you to re-authenticate at that point.
Yep, absolutely. And so it becomes this balancing act between, you know, from the user perspective, they just want to get their job done. From the application provider, from like the ISV perspective, I want to be able to open up my application to the broadest range of users.
Right.
I want to get the most users coming into my application. From the security perspective, I want to be able to exert the appropriate security policy on my data.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it comes down to the data. It doesn't come down to whether the application is sitting on your corporate network or sitting up in Azure or in EC2 or wherever it is. I don't care where your application is. I don't care where your services are running. I care about the importance of the data.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be able to make authorization and policy decisions that can differentiate the menu in the cafeteria this week versus accessing my source code.
Right. Yeah, versus credit card numbers and the like.
Exactly.
Well, I think we get, I still don't feel like we're getting better at the authentication problem, but this aspect of elements of my identity, my credit card numbers, my other kinds of preferences. And I always go back to Dick Hart's OSCON presentation, which was really around Skip, this idea of, you know, what my preferences are for things, that sort of package of information going with me. I mean, we have some of this in AD, although even that has portability problems at times.
Yep, Active Directory certainly assumes a, you know, well-connected corporate network, which is why we introduced the levels of indirection through things like ADFS and ECS and other, you know, third-party security token services, so that you can take your on-premise identity, which in the case of a Microsoft shop is your Active Directory identity, and take that identity and expose it and port it out to applications sitting in the cloud, sitting out on the internet, sitting out on a partner site, and so that you can then expose your identity, your authentication, and your authorization data out to somewhere that's not necessarily on-prem.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, ADFS is, I feel like it's the starting point of that. It's still not that easy to get everything working right and to actually get agreements around. If you've got, you know, a set of policies for this app, how does that propagate to that app? You know, that's hard. It's still hard work to make all that
go together. There is definitely a handshake involved, because there is the handshake between what am I sending in terms of my claim types? What am I sending from the ADFS server versus what are you expecting to receive on the application side? And we're back to the old world where everything's case sensitive. And so it's, I have this running joke about ADFS, which is that if something is broken in ADFS, it's PKI.
Right.
And if it's not PKI, it's a typo. And if it's not a typo, it's PKI. We're trying to make that better and better moving forward. And I think that as a very serious ADFS zealot, I mean, you know my Twitter handle. My Twitter is ADFS Kitty. So, you know, I'm a big ADFS fan. When ADFS was first released way back in 2005, it was a V1 product, and you really, really had to understand PKI to be able to get it to work. But as we've been moving it forward, and as we've been improving the product, and as things like Azure and cloud adoption have made ADFS and things of its ilk far more relevant, it's now incumbent on the makers of the STSs, which in the case of ADFS is Microsoft, it is now incumbent on us to make that technology consumable by the masses.
Right.
You know, if I want to enable cloud adoption for, you know, small and medium businesses, I can't hand them a product that they can't install. You know, I can't hand them a product where, yeah, here's this product and it's great, but you're going to have to, you know, pay a consultant $11 billion to get it to work. You know, that model doesn't work. It needs to be almost like an appliance. It needs to be something that you can plug in and three clicks and you're on the internet.
And it just works. Yeah, I'm feeling like cloud technology is going to drive forward both the concept of the token services of ADFS and claims-based security. Like those two elements, things we've been needing for ages to solve these other problems. Finally, it's like we have an incentive. You want to use the cloud, and you're going to need these bits to work to make the cloud make sense against your enterprise.
Yep, absolutely. And claims-based authentication and the claims-based security model, the thing that they do is they make your applications portable. So we have, within Microsoft IT, we have a couple of hundred applications that are leveraging claims-based authentication that are not actually in the cloud. They're actually sitting on on-prem servers. But what it means is when those applications want to move to the cloud, their authentication model doesn't change. They were using ADFS before. They're going to use ADFS tomorrow.
Yeah.
And they can move from on-prem up to Azure. They can move from on-prem, you know, to pretty much anywhere else. And the authentication model does not change, because ADFS creates that layer of abstraction between the on-prem identity and wherever this application chooses to reside.
Yeah, the thought of having that transparent and just working is pretty stunning. At the same time, I think there's a fair bit of, you know, the main thing I think holding back cloud adoption these days is the fear around the security elements. I'm going to push an awful lot of fairly private identity information out into the cloud in some form. You know, I've dealt with more than one company now where the idea of just opening up the firewalls to external communication to the ADFS servers terrifies them.
And that's certainly something that I think the whole industry is looking at, is not just identity information, but just the application data. Is that there's this notion of, oh my God, it's up in the cloud. How is it being secured in the cloud relative to how I am securing it today?
Right.
And the question becomes, do I at least have parity? it's this. We're not saying, you know, no one is saying that the cloud is more secure or less secure than anything else. What we're looking for is parity.
And so most of the time, I'm finding that actually most organizations aren't as secure as the cloud. That the process of evaluating that and really studying it shows more weaknesses on-prem than the policies and organizational elements that are around most cloud providers. Most cloud providers are far more organized and skilled at doing this.
Which is one of the benefits. Which is one of the benefits of moving to the cloud model is that you're getting that economy of scale. You're getting
right.
that, you know, really big cloud provider who has lots of staff that know how to do their jobs.
Mm-hmm. That are specialists in that particular mm-hmm. space. You can afford and they have multiple specialists just on dealing with those issues. But I think where this really breaks down, the challenging part is that interaction between the cloud and on-premise. It's setting up ADFS to communicate to Office 365 to do authentication for Exchange. That piece seems to be the hard bit.
So there's setting up ADFS to speak to Exchange in O365. There's the directory sync piece mm-hmm. because Exchange still needs a GAL.
Yeah.
So even if you're using federated auth to give you the single sign-on, which your users love, they're not going to bring their GAL with them in their token. So you're still going to need to do some level of directory sync. SharePoint's the same way. SharePoint needs a people picker.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're taking things that we used to take for granted because they all just lived in Active Directory. You know,
yep.
Your GAL lived in Active Directory. Your people picker lived in Active Directory. And we're taking all these things that we used to take for granted on-prem and figuring out how do we project this information to the cloud so that our users can, you know, leverage these really cool services. And how can we do so in a secure manner? And how can we do so in a way that the average IT person can reasonably configure and consume and use?
Right. And there are no easy answers here. We're still figuring all this stuff out, right?
Well, I love my job.
Yeah, well, and I know I can't ask you specifically about what Microsoft's doing in that particular area, but it sounds like an area that would be of interest to them sometime in the future.
It's certainly something. The identity space is moving fast and furious, and we have, you know, we've got a lot of really smart guys in the product groups who are looking at exactly the kind of problems the kind of challenges that you and I have been talking about.
Sure.
And they're looking at what are we going to do about, you know, improving the strength of authentication?
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do about making it easier to project identities into the cloud? And really smart people are working on problems.
Well, and to me, it's really exciting that Microsoft makes the best products when they use their products internally. By the time we get them, you know, but you've shed the blood so that we don't have to. I think we'll end up with better tools that way.
And that's just a big part of why I enjoy working for Microsoft IT, because it provides me the ability to have that very early influence into the product development cycle.
Sure.
Where, you know, folks on my team will see something that, you know, a guy from the product group or a woman from the product group will come up with a feature that they think is just the greatest thing they've ever heard of in their life, and they think it's just an awesome idea.
Yeah.
And they pitch it to me, and I say, well, did you think about this? Did you think about this? Did you think about that? And here are the ways that, from an enterprise perspective, you know, I'm not saying your thing's not going to work, but here are ways that it might, you know, be made better.
Sure.
And so it's just really exciting.
Absolutely. Well, Laura, always fun to talk to you. Sounds like you're working on some great stuff, and I hope you will be back when we can talk about some of those dog fooding experiences.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Call me back in a couple of months when I can talk about some of the Win8 dog food that we're having. it'll be a lot of fun.
I bet. Laura Hunter, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.